How did Putin rise to power, and how much should we be worried that he stayed there? Stephen Lee Myers will join us to talk about his new biography, The New Tsar.
He's embraced not just the Soviet traditions, the instincts that he's always had, but he's embracing a kind of vision of the leader of the state in a very czar-like way, the imperial czar.
What happens when one set of twin boys realizes he is a she? Amy Ellis Nutt will be here to discuss her new book, Becoming Nicole, The Transformation of an American Family.
Nicole, even as Wyatt, was always who she was, a twin who really liked girls' things, who in the beginning called herself a girl boy.
Our children's books editor, Maria Russo, joins me for a conversation about our biggest children's book issue of the year. Alexander Alter will give us an update from the literary world, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Stephen Lee Myers joins us now from Los Angeles, where he is on book tour for his new book, The New Tsar, The Rise and Reign of Vladimir Putin. Hi, Steve.
Good morning.
So you are currently a national security correspondent for The Times, but for a long time, you were in Russia as bureau chief.
That's right.
Okay.
I started working there in 2002 to 2007. Returned in 2013 for another year and a half or so.
Did you know when you were there that you wanted to write a book about something about Russia? Did you know you wanted to write about Putin?
When I was there the first time, this idea came up, and I discussed it with people and with my agent, Larry Weissman. And I often said, you know, we don't know how this is going to end. At the time, Putin was wrestling with the idea of would he return to the presidency, stay on as president for life, and so forth. He eventually, of course, handed power over to his protege and served as prime minister for a few years. So at the time, I thought, you know, it's too soon. And then when he announced that he was going to come back to the presidency, essentially a primary of one voter himself, that's when I thought there needed to be a book to explain how he was able to do that and wield such power.
So for people who are constantly confused about that, could you just quickly explain, Medvedev is the current president, and Vladimir Putin is the current prime minister?
Putin was president for two terms, and then the constitution in Russia limits the president to two terms. And at that point, he faced a question of whether or not to change the constitution. So rather than do that, which I think is very important to understanding him, he handed power officially to Dmitry Medvedev, who's a very close aide of his, has been for decades. Medvedev served as president then for 4 years, with Putin appointed as his prime minister. They called it the tandem, like a bicycle. The two leaders would lead the country together. Though nominally, Medvedev was for 4 years head of state. And his reelection came up. That's when Putin intervened and said that no, he was going to return and run, quote unquote, for the office of the presidency. That, and then he took over again in 2012.
So can they just both keep cycling out of these roles?
You know, in principle, yeah. And some people think that that's exactly what might happen. You know, they did change the length of the presidential term to 6 years. So Putin can serve now until 2018, his next reelection. And I use election very loosely. And then serve a second term again, which would keep him in power until 2024. So honestly, I think at this point, Putin's not really thinking about the question of secession again, but eventually he'll have to.
So he's effectively ruled Russia for the last 15 years.
And a little bit longer and counting.
How did he get there?
You know, I think one of the most fascinating things about Putin's biography is how in a matter of 3 short years, he arrived in Moscow as a fairly low-level bureaucrat in the government. The mayor he had worked for in Petersburg had been beaten in an election, you know, back when there were still somewhat democratic elections in Russia, and Putin was out of work, and he showed up in Moscow. He slept on a friend's couch and finally got a job in the bureaucracy in the Kremlin. Very short amount of time began to rise up through the ranks, and it almost seems accidental in a way, because, you know, it was the time when Yeltsin was under a lot of pressure, both because of his health, but also scandals surrounding him. And, you know, there was a fiscal crisis in Russia in 1998. And each time Yeltsin would reshuffle his government, Putin would seem to float up to a little bit higher and more important post. By all accounts, conducted himself very professionally and competently which stood out in Russia at the time, where there was a lot of intrigue and fighting going on. And eventually, you know, that drew Yeltsin's attention, and he began to see him as somebody that he could trust, somebody who wasn't ambitious, who didn't seem to be gunning for the job, Yeltsin's own job. And that gave Yeltsin even more confidence in him. And so in a matter of again, 3 short years, he arrives in Moscow kind of as a nobody, and then Yeltsin turns to him as prime minister in August of 1999. And again, because he was appointing prime ministers every few months at that point, mm-hmm. most people thought Putin would just come and go. He managed to really impress not only Yeltsin and the people around him, but also the voters. And so his popularity skyrocketed, and Yeltsin then on the New Year's Eve of the new millennium decided to appoint him president, acting president, when he stepped down.
So Yeltsin may have considered Putin unambitious, but I'm assuming you would disagree with that characterization.
You know, I think actually at the time Yeltsin was right. He didn't show a great deal of political ambition, certainly. He wasn't a job he seemed to seek at all. In Yeltsin's own account of when he decided to tell him, appoint him to this job, Putin said he wasn't ready for it. There's no question since then, since he's had the office, that he's pursued his vision of Russia very ambitiously.
What is his motivation? That's the big question, I guess.
First of all, as a political leader, I think that he has a sense that many Russians do of grievance and loss for the power that the Soviet Union once was. Even if they lament many aspects of the Soviet Union, the political repression and so forth, most people want to return to a Russia, at least, that had the kind of superpower status, the respect in the world that the Soviet Union once had. You know, that's the Soviet Union of Putin's youth. And so I think his biggest ambition, above all, is to create, again, a great Russia. There is also an element, I think, of protecting his own power and protecting those who are around him who've become enriched by his power. You know, the cronies, they're called sometimes, the people who have been sanctioned by the United States and Europe because of the actions in Ukraine.
But you call him, in the title of your book, the new czar, which obviously isn't a Soviet term. Did you choose that word deliberately?
You know, if you look back in history, the leader in Russia and then the Soviet Union, there's a certain consistency in the you know, singular force of the leader. Even in Soviet times, there was a little bit more of a Politburo that they had to navigate. But it was a deliberate choice because I think early on in his presidency and his rule, you know, he would eschew this notion of the cult of personality. He would even speak out against it, and he would talk about institutions and the office of the presidency, respecting the Constitution as he did when he decided not to change it and just become president for life. But increasingly, especially since he's returned, he's embraced not just the Soviet traditions, the instincts that he's always had, but he's embracing a kind of vision of the leader of the state in a very czar-like way. The imperial czars, unchallengeable, you know, even providential in some respects. You know, the close relation between the church and the state. You know, there are aspects of his power that I think are reaching deeper, much deeper into history.
One definitely Soviet term that's used to describe him as the eternal KGB man. Do you see him that way?
I think that there's no question that that's a huge part of his background and his character. I mean, he wanted to join the KGB when he was an impressionable young teenager, seeing a film, quite good film actually, about a secret agent in World War II. And from that point on, I think it's his view of the intelligence services, of the security services, and how important they are to the security of the state, you know, to personal security, to the people that he feels like he can trust. His closest friends are all people he served with in the KGB, even went to school with, you know, in the 1970s. So I think it's inseparable from who he is, though in a much more complicated way than some people characterize it as just once a KGB agent, always a KGB agent. You know, he did resign from KGB after the coup in 1991, you know, broke with the agency in a way, but nonetheless, his respect for the security services, for the work of the intelligence, seems to be a huge part of his character and increasingly policy of Russia.
In Russia, how is he viewed? Is that different? Is the perception within Russia different from our perception of him?
You know, recently his opinion rating in the poll that's been done consistently since he came to office reached its highest point ever, almost 90%, 89.9. And, you know, I take polls with a grain of salt.
I was going to say, how reliable
are
they?
Especially, I'm impressed that there are still 10% of people who will tell a stranger on the phone that they don't support the president. But there's no question that he has genuine popularity in Russia among people. The annexation of Crimea, which has caused a horrible breach in Russia's international relations, was widely cheered across Russian society. And I think a lot of that has to do with the power of propaganda, you know, that there is a singular message that people consume because of state control of media. Even during hard periods when, you know, the economy has faltered, you know, there have been natural disasters, there have been terrorist attacks before in Russia, and another one apparently this weekend. And, you know, there's a resilience to his power and his popularity that I think stems from that desire or that culture in Russia of wanting to have a strong man. I think that nostalgia I was talking about of being a great state again, the economy may be terrible, jobs may be coming undone, corruption inside Russia, you know, is horrible, and many Russians feel it day to day, and yet they like the idea of the strong leader standing up to the world, standing up to Obama, standing up to Merkel, being a tough guy, Russia's back. You know, you saw that in the Olympics, you know. We're a great state again, you know, after this quarter century of chaos following the collapse of the Soviet Union. And it's a powerful narcotic, I think, for people. And they really want to believe that. They don't want to believe that they're a falling or diminished power.
Given the fact that the economy is so bad and that so many Russians have seen their standard of living fall, how does Putin maintain that popularity?
I think partly it is rallying people behind the state again, and the sense of the besieged state. I mean, we don't see it because we sit in the United States or in Europe and look at Russia from the outside. But from the information that ordinary Russians receive, the information that permeates the government, I mean, the entire political discourse is of Russia under attack. And it's under attack from the United States. They don't explain that the reason the U.S. is doing this is because they annexed Crimea and that's a violation of international law. They don't hear that. They just hear the U.S. is trying to topple our country, trying to make us weak, push us back down to our knees. And you feel it. I felt it when I was there last, of the kind of rising anti-American sentiment. It kind of is turned up and down as necessary. And right now it's at full volume. Of a sense of the country under siege, you know, defending itself against the barbarians, defending itself against the terrorists in Syria and in Ukraine. The sanctions, yes, the economy is hurting because the Americans put sanctions on us and they drove down the price of oil. And so we have to unify against this horrible threat to our country. And, you know, that's something that resonates very deeply going back to Napoleon's invasion and certainly the Nazi invasion more recently. And, you know, it rallies people in a very effective way.
The impression is that Putin is not suffering financially after 15 years in power. I mean, to what extent is he involved in the corruption? Has he aided the corruption? Has he benefited from it?
I think it's hard to argue at this point that he has not created or at least dominated a system of favoritism, of contracts going to large corporations that are headed by people close to him. He's put his own people in charge of every important state industry. The state oil company is run by somebody who's an old, also security veteran that he's known since the early 90s. I don't think it's possible for people to say that Putin hasn't created the climate of impunity when it comes to corruption. Not that he's involved in every single corrupt deal. Mm-hmm. I don't think he takes, you know, 25% of major contracts and stuffs the money into a mattress somewhere. I don't think it works that way. It's a much more informal understanding. But there's no question, and people have sought to measure this, experts, that corruption is worse than it's ever been in Russia.
So there's no effort on his part, as there would be in the States, to portray himself as a kind of man of the people.
I think he very much does that. I mean, I think the whole Kremlin propaganda apparatus is devoted to that. I'm not sure it's as persuasive as it used to be, because now he's almost more like the father of the people, you know, and the, going back to the image of the Tsar, you know, they'll periodically announce that they're fighting corruption. And, you know, every now and then a minister might be arrested, usually not so high ranking. And usually the case fizzles out. But they send messages that way that, of course, we're fighting corruption. But then, you know, the contracts keep going to favored companies and so forth.
I want to bring up Putin's most recent birthday party, because I think, you know, reading about it over here, it would be very hard for Americans to understand how that might go over in Russia. Certainly, I think if Obama threw himself that kind of birthday party here, it wouldn't fly.
I was really struck by him playing hockey, which he's been doing, actually. He took this up quite kind of late in life. I think he was already 60. And with great zeal and determination, he learned how to skate and wield a puck and plays with, again, some of these same business cronies that he's known forever since his childhood. He created an amateur hockey league. They call it the Night Hockey League. And the idea was to promote physical fitness and everything. The notion that the news agencies in Russia would cover this charity hockey match as though it were a real thing, and Putin scoring goal after goal after goal, you know, 7 goals on his birthday, quite a huge accomplishment for a 63-year-old man.
Among professional players.
Yeah, but, you know, it was amazing how the goalie just kind of lost it. He couldn't stop a shot when the leader was skating at him. It was really quite remarkable. The fact that it was covered in such a adoring, even serious way. I mean, sometimes I think it's all tongue-in-cheek. And I actually asked a Russian journalist about this very specifically, like, who doesn't see that? It's just transparently idiotic. and she said she thought it was. She saw it. She said she thought most people understood that it's a show, it's a performance. And yes, of course, no one's going to check the president to stop him from scoring, but that it's powerful nonetheless, because it is the creating this leader. She says it's very important for women of a certain age to see the strong leader, you know, the male figure doing well, performing well at, you know, an age when Russian men are already over the hill. So as ludicrous as we see it to be, a quite effective strategy in a sort of classical propagandistic way.
George Bush famously misunderstood Putin, or misread him, the whole looking into his eyes incident. How well do you think Obama understands Putin, and what is Putin's perception of Obama?
You know, in fairness to George Bush, his quote was sometimes misunderstood and misquoted. He said he got a sense of the man's soul. And what he said, importantly, is that he saw him as a leader who cared about Russia and cared about Russia's security interest, which actually is kind of true. The one thing that he missed about Putin, I think, and he came to realize this himself, was that he thought Putin was trustworthy, and he felt that Putin wasn't in the end, that over the, you know, long presidencies overlapping, they came to really distrust each other. Obama came in when Medvedev was in his interim role as president. They understood in the Obama administration that Putin remained a very important figure. But through protocol, they respected the office of the president as head of state and interacted with Medvedev in a way that they hoped would continue into a second term, that would continue to create the institution of the presidency in Russia separate from Vladimir Putin. You know, they made some progress, they'll say, in terms of arms control and World Trade Organization talks and things like that with Medvedev and Obama. The minute that Putin announced that he was coming back to the presidency, the disappointment in Washington and other capitals was palpable, and Putin felt it. Putin understood that that he was not welcomed back as a leader, and he took that as an insult, a personal insult. And I think that soured that relationship from the very beginning. And there was really no hope of recovering, partly because Putin, when he came back, you know, much more nationalistic, much more aggressive and anti-American. He saw that what was happening around the world as being orchestrated by the United States, even when it wasn't. And, you know, events in the Arab Spring, events in Ukraine, Putin sees the U.S. as fighting against his return to power. He's very much personalized the idea of power in Russia.
All right. Well, the title then of your new book is very fitting, The New Tsar, The Rise and Reign of Vladimir Putin by Stephen Lee Myers. Steve, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. It's great.
Alexandra Alter joins us now with notes from the literary world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
So you've got new Amazon news.
Yes, there's new Amazon news, and it's fairly surprising. They've opened their first brick-and-mortar bookstore in Seattle, and this is something that had been rumored for several months. People were speculating about what the store might be like, but it's still surprising that it actually happened, you know, 20 years after Amazon entered the online retail business, that they would open a physical store.
What does the store look like?
You know, when the rumor started that Amazon was opening its first physical store, a lot of people thought it might be kind of a showcase for Amazon's devices, their Kindles, their tablets, or it would be a place to pick up Amazon orders, or it would just stock books that are published by Amazon through their own imprints. But in fact, it looks pretty much like a normal bookstore. They have 5,000 to 6,000 titles, which is actually rather small. The differences are significant, though. They've sort of incorporated Amazon customer reviews into the store in an interesting way. For example, some of the categories are most wished for cookbooks, you know, and they're looking at Amazon data to see which cookbooks people are looking for. The store also has a staff favorite section, which is, of course, a hallmark of many independent bookstores. But the difference at the Amazon store is that for the opening, the section included a few of Jeff Bezos' own favorite titles, including The Five Love Languages by Gary Chapman and Traps by his own wife, Mackenzie Bezos. Here's his review of Traps, a page-turner written by an award-winning novelist who also happens to be my wife.
One thing that has seemed to be an issue for Amazon's own publishing programs is getting stocked in bookstores. You alluded to that earlier. Are all of Amazon's own imprints titles in this new store?
You know, I'm not sure if they're stocking all of them. I'm sure they're stocking some of the more popular ones, but I think they really wanted to emphasize that this wasn't going to be an Amazon showcase store, and it's selling a whole diverse range of books. And as Jennifer Kast, who's the vice president of Amazon Books, told the Seattle Times, you know, they are using the store, the website data to sort of decide which books to put in there, but she said, quote, it's data with heart. They're not just picking the most popular titles. They're also looking at the quality of reviews. One of the bookstore sections is award winners 4.5 stars and above. So you can see how they're sort of culling data from their website to sort of decide what to put in the store. And, you know, this is an experiment for them. They're a very experimental company. And they've said that if this succeeds, they'll be looking at other locations in other cities.
In terms of where the bookstore is now, is there a dearth of bookstores in Seattle or in that area of Seattle, or is it directly competing against an existing brick and mortar?
Well, there is a healthy independent bookstore community in Seattle, so it's not as though there was an absence of stores and they're filling the void. I believe there was a Barnes & Noble in that area that had closed. So there is an absence in that regard. But I think there's a pretty healthy independent community there.
What's the reaction been like so far from the Seattle literary scene?
It's interesting. There have been, of course, in this age of the internet, there have been some customer reviews of the store itself. Some people have said it feels a little strange to go and shop in a physical store run by Amazon, and it doesn't necessarily have the best, you know, some people said the customer experience wasn't, somebody gave it 2 stars, for example. But it was their first week. They opened on Tuesday, so there's a chance that they're ironing out some kinks.
And what's their goal? Why do this?
You know, I think this is something they've been looking to do. There were rumors that they were looking at a space in Manhattan as well. One sort of speculation is that independent stores are sort of coming back, and maybe they've decided that there's some value in face-to-face store interactions and they want to have a little bit of a toehold in that. If it is indeed a test and they're planning to expand around the country, it could also be kind of a PR move to put a friendlier face on the company. They've had a lot of negative publicity this year. First, there was the standoff with Hachette when they were delaying shipments and removing the buy button from some Hachette books as they were negotiating their contracts. Then there was the big article and series in the New York Times about, how workers there are put through this grueling system. And so I think, you know, there could be a kind of PR angle where if you have face-to-face interactions, people might start to see Amazon more as, you know, a lover of books and a supporter of books, which is definitely how the company views itself, but it's not always how it's portrayed.
Amazon also had some other good people news emerge this week in terms of their own family policies.
They've actually provided better parental leave now for their employees. So that's some good news as well for Amazon employees.
All right. Well, people will now have time to take care of their kids and read books. Thanks, Alexandra.
Exactly. Thanks for having me.
Amy Ellis Nutt joins us from Washington. She is the author of Becoming Nicole, The Transformation of an American Family. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
This book is about transgender children, which is certainly a current topic, but I imagine that you started working on the book before it was so in the news. How long have you been working on this?
Probably we started about 3.5 years ago, and honestly, at the very beginning, I was fascinated by the family. The transgender child is part of an identical twin pair. But at the time, I actually did say to my agent, this is fascinating, but are you sure anyone's going to want to read about a transgender child? So all credit goes to my agent for her foresight.
But it was a little bit in the air. I mean, there had been a story, yeah. I think, at that time in The Atlantic about kind of how young is it, quote unquote, okay to let a child express him or herself as another gender.
In fact, honestly, this story, I give all credit to Bella English at the Boston Globe, who wrote about it first for them in December of 2011. At that time, there was some media response to it, it's true, and the family did not want to pursue those at the time. They really wanted to protect their kids, you know, early teens, and wanted them to grow up. So they were looking sort of, you know, down the line at perhaps someday writing a book. So it was with that in mind that this was something that wouldn't come out until they had graduated college, that they agreed to do this.
How did you come across the family?
I got together with the family really through serendipity because they were represented at the time by a lawyer, Jennifer Levy, who is someone that I had known in a former life as a perennial graduate student in Boston years earlier. And I had just published a book, and my name was sort of in the news, and so she saw that and she thought, well, I know an author. Maybe she would be interested in doing this story. So it was complete luck that I was able to be the one to write about them.
Your day job is as a health and science writer at The Washington Post. How much did that background and that expertise in writing about, you know, issues from the health and science perspective inform the research and writing of this book?
A lot, Pamela. Actually, the previous book that I'd done to this, I'd done before Becoming Nicole, was co-authoring with Frances Jensen about the teenage brain. And my book before that was actually a story about a man who basically undergoes a stroke and a personality transformation and a compulsion to do art. And so both of those stories were obviously heavily involved in neuroscience. And so it was kind of a perfect background in which to take a look at this story, not only from obviously the aspect of how does a family deal with this, a very ordinary middle-class family, but what does science tell us about what's going on?
Let's talk about that ordinary family, the parents, Wayne and Kelly Maines. Who are they? Where do they live? What's their background?
Wayne and Kelly live in Maine. They met about 20, 25 years ago. Wayne is the head of director of safety for the University of Maine school system. Kelly works in the sheriff's office. They had wanted to have children, were unable to, but were able to adopt. And Wayne came from a very classic small town upstate New York, grew up hunting, military veteran, described himself early on as being conservative Republican. He's still conservative, even if he's not Republican. And Kelly grew up in the Midwest. She was also adopted, but not a traditional family life. She left home at 17. So they had different backgrounds. And I think that counted a lot for, especially for Kelly, how she was able to embrace raising this child early on. She had no expectations about what a perfect family looked like. she wasn't worried about being disappointed if her child didn't turn out to be exactly what she wanted. And so I think that it equipped her really well to, from the very beginning, understand that her child was trying to tell her something, and not that this was a problem, just that there was something different.
And who are the children, born Jonas and Wyatt?
Yes, born Jonas and Wyatt, identical twins, but from the age of two, Wyatt identified as a girl, barely sort of able to talk. It was clear and consistent and constant from that early age that she thought of herself as a girl.
How did she show that?
Certainly right from the beginning, and it wasn't just a matter of playing with Barbie dolls or dressing up, but she would say things to her mother and father, you know, when do I get to be a girl? When will my penis fall off? Daddy, I hate my penis. I mean, you know, at the age of two, you obviously don't have a way of expressing gender, a sense of gender or gender identity, except as something very basic from her being. And so this was something much stronger than simply experiencing what it's like to sort of play with toys that are different, you know, from her gender.
What year was this?
So they were born in October of 1997. So really, it's the late 90s. And frankly, you know, for Kelly, in the first few years, trying to understand her child, you know, she basically sat down one day and, like you can imagine many modern parents do, literally typed into, you know, Google, boys who like girls' toys. And that's where it began. In the late 90s, you know, she had not really heard the word transgender, didn't understand it. And so it was all very much an education for her.
What was it like where they were living in Maine to have a child who identified this way so young?
Well, you know, precisely because Nicole, when she was Wyatt, identified so early on, she grew up basically with friends who accepted her for who she was, which was, in the beginning, looked like a boy sort of on the outside, but very soon was growing her hair and dressing more feminine, although it was a slow process. So they basically accepted her. There were occasions with some teasing, but very little of it. So she grew up kind of confident. It wasn't until really the fifth grade and the summer before the fifth grade when she was able to legally change her name, to which most of her classmates said, well, finally. But there was one boy at the sort of being pushed by and probably manipulated by a grandfather, began harassing her by following her into the girls' room.
And how did the school handle that?
You know, unfortunately, they were trying to figure things out along the way, but it appears that they kind of caved into the fear of lawsuits, which the grandfather was actually threatening. He was trying to make a point that, you know, he didn't believe that girls who were anatomically boys should be allowed in girls' restrooms. The school made a decision basically to assign Nicole to a staff restroom, essentially separate but unequal, essentially segregating her. As much as Kelly and then eventually Wayne tried to talk to the school, they were supported by counselors and teachers, but the administration just didn't seem to really get it. It took them filing a lawsuit to actually get the law changed in the state of Maine.
You said eventually, Wayne, I think the transformation in your subtitle, The Transformation of an American Family, is as much about Wayne as it is about Nicole. What was his reaction and how did his views evolve?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The biggest transformation really in the book is Wayne. And today he goes around and he talks to people about raising a transgender child, and especially to fathers, because he wants them to understand. It took his wife, it took his self-education, and it took both his daughter and his son for him to realize. But most especially, it was when his daughter was threatened and harassed that, as the good father that he is, he sort of rose to the occasion. It was also at times when his son Jonas said, Dad, you know, face it, you have a son and a daughter. And he says his family taught him.
What was the relationship like between Jonas and Nicole?
Jonas and Nicole are wonderfully different and in many ways turn gender on its head in other ways, too. Jonas is someone who's much more poetic and philosophical. Nicole actually, freely admits that, you know, Jonas is much more sensitive than she is. People ask Jonas, well, what was it like, you know, when you realized, you know, your brother, you know, was a sister? But there was no point in which he made that realization. Nicole, even as Wyatt, was always who she was, which was a twin who really liked girls' things, who in the beginning called herself a girl boy. And so the transition, you know, to Nicole was as seamless in some ways for him as it was for Nicole.
How old are Jonas and Nicole now?
They just turned 18. They're both freshmen at different branches of the University of Maine. And as far as I know, and I've seen them tweeting in the middle of the night when they're staying up studying, they're both having, you know, fairly typical college experiences.
And was the release of this book deliberately after they turned 18?
It was certainly deliberate in that the parents didn't want this book to come out before the kids finished high school and really had been through their teen years and were launched. So in terms of timing, obviously, it's at a fascinating moment in American cultural history.
What was their motivation in allowing you into their lives and wanting this book to be written?
Kelly was focused on her kids the whole time. And I think Wayne, because of the transformation he underwent, felt this very powerful need to tell his story, especially to men. And I think Kelly also recognized that while she didn't want this to infringe on her kids growing up, that they had a powerful story to tell. I mean, this is a very ordinary family. This is a family that's hard not to relate to. They have the same gifts, the same flaws, the same problems. And if it's not a transgender child, it's you know, other families can identify with other issues. And it's about not just obviously Nicole finding herself, but it's a family finding its identity. And they wanted people to understand especially what it's like to have a child and to raise a child who's transgender. You know, prior to this, we'd heard mostly from adults who'd had to keep this, you know, secret from their families for many years. And this is a situation where it was not a secret in this family. So they were dealing with it right from the beginning. How they did, and at times didn't, I think they knew would be instructive for many, many people.
And it's a story very powerfully told in Becoming Nicole, The Transformation of an American Family by Amy Ellis Nutt. Amy, thanks again.
Thank you, Pamela.
Maria Russo, our children's books editor, joins us now. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Pamela.
So it's that exciting time of year for those who love children's literature. It's our biggest issue of the year.
We have so many great reviews in this issue. I will start with picture books. Always fun to start with. We have a fantastic review by the novelist Samantha Hunt, who's also a mom of three, on three really interesting books about really small children, babies and toddlers, and how they relate to their parents in funny ways. One of them is called The Menino, and it's a fantastic kind of fact-based look at what actually are these strange creatures called babies.
I should say that this book is not just for small children. This book is for everyone.
It's true. Every grown-up who's seen this book has also been delighted and laughed at it, because it does look at babies and say, they're so strange. Why do they move like they're swimming through the water? You know, in the air, they're swimming through the air. Why, you know, what are those strange noises that they make?
And it's all told through the sort of the voice and the perspective of an older sibling. One of my favorite lines in it is about the baby. The way that he describes a baby waking up in the middle of the night is, you know, he calls the baby the menino, which I think means...
It's from the Portuguese. It's just a kind of a Portuguese endearment. It means like little kid, basically.
Little kid. He says, you know, the menino's alarm goes off in the middle of the night. And it's just full of, you know, this amazing...
Exotic. It's an exotic creature, which it is, too. It's true to an older sibling.
And then another book in that particular roundup is illustrated by the great Marla Freese.
That's another one of my favorites in this issue. It's called Is Mommy? The author is Victoria Chang. It's a tiny child saying to their mom, is mommy tall or short? And the answer is always short. Or is mommy pretty or ugly? Ugly. But it's said with such joy, and Marla Freese's illustrations are so exuberant. And then at the end, the last question is, but do you love your, you know, short, ugly, boring mommy? Yes. And you really see, you know, a little bit more of a subversive take on the parent-child relationship.
Marlo Frazee illustrated Everywhere Babies, which I think is like one of the go-to books.
She has so many great ones. The other book in there that's really interesting is a wordless book by a debut by a Chinese author-illustrator named Guo Jing. It's called The Only Child. Interesting right now because it's kind of, you could call it a protest picture book. It's protesting the only child policy in China that was recently ended. So it's a long wordless story of a very lonely child with no siblings and no one around who's left alone. And so it kind of ends up in this fantasy, beautiful fantasy adventure in a cloud wonderland. But the author has talked about the book coming out of this deep sadness she felt growing up under the one child policy.
Seemed to be a historical
snapshot. I think this book is an interesting one.
Let's talk about like the big children's novels of this fall. I think the big one is probably Rick Riordan's
book. There's a new series that Rick Riordan of Percy Jackson fame has started, and it's called Magnus Chase and the Gods of Asgard. This first installment is called The Sword of Summer. And now he's taking on Norse mythology instead of Greek mythology. And we have a review by Adam Gopnik, which is great to read. And Adam talks a lot about the difference between Greek mythology and Norse mythology.
Are Norse gods as good in terms of fodder for kids?
They're a little
bit
more, I think they are. It's just a little bit more of a dark universe. It's a little bit less heroic, and Norse gods tend to be a little bit more resigned to fate and to the tragedy of the human condition, whereas Greek gods are a little bit more heroic and adventurous, I would say.
Well, we live in dark times.
Yes, it's appropriate.
And there's some other big names who've come out with new books this fall.
Yeah, we have a great review of Lewis Sackar's new book, Fuzzy Mud, which has already made its appearance for weeks on the bestseller list, a middle grade book. The plot involves a corporate conspiracy to pollute and poison the environment that these two children have to discover and try to thwart. It's very timely, and I think kids are really responding to that book.
And Sackar wrote Holes, which was turned into a movie. And the review is by Elliot Schreffer, who our readers might know is the author of Endangered, right?
Endangered, right. He writes really well about environmental issues for children.
All right, a couple of books by librarian favorites, Jack Gantos, D. Schmidt.
We have a review of two short novels that are similar in theme about troubled middle school boys who kind of have, at that moment where they have a decision to make, are they going to go with that charismatic older boy who you know is not going to bring you to great places, or are you going to resist? And what happens so often is how hard it is to resist the lure of this older boy who you know is trouble, but he's fascinating and thrilling to you. And both of them handle that theme really nicely in those books.
Before we talk about our personal favorites of the season, let's touch on YA. Is there a big standout YA book reviewed in this issue?
Well, I loved The Hired Girl by Laura Amy Schlitz, another multiple award winner. And this is a book set in 1911 about a girl who comes from an isolated farm environment in Pennsylvania who was raised Catholic and runs away from her abusive father after her mother dies and is taken in by a cultivated, affluent Jewish family in Baltimore. And I think this is, you don't often see religion treated in novels in YA novels so honestly and sensitively. And it's funny. And it's also a book that is very much in the tradition of the young book-loving heroine, you know, Jane Eyre and Ivanhoe are books that are kind of embedded in the plot of this novel. The heroine wants to better herself through literature, and that's kind of a timeless plot that's nice to see done so well.
We like that plot
here. We love that plot.
All right, before you go, Maria, is there like one or two books that you want to call out?
We're coming to this a little bit late just because our issue is in November, but I really loved Sonia Manzano's memoir, Becoming Maria, Love and Chaos in the South Bronx. Sonia Manzano, of course, of Sesame Street fame. And, you know, I, for one, am always surprised when someone who is so talented in one area can also write. And she's one of those people. She's kind of the Patti Smith, I think, for children's literature. It's a beautiful, powerful book. that I think this is one that I would recommend for adults or teenagers. It's about her childhood and her teenage years and her time at Carnegie Mellon University, where she suddenly realized, wow, I actually can become an actress. I can create art and change my life. And it's really beautiful and well done.
All right. Lots of great books for people of all ages. Thanks, Maria. Greg Coles joins us now with lots of bestseller news. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on this list?
Yes, there
everything.
Is. on the fiction side, there are five new titles. Starting down at number 13, Glenn Beck, the conservative radio host, has a novel called The Immortal Nicholas. It's a Santa Claus novel. It's imagining a history for Santa Claus that ties him all the way back to the origins of the Christ story. So putting the Christ back in Christmas.
Is it a conservative Santa Claus story?
yeah, sure. It's a Christian Santa Claus story. Then at number 11, David Mitchell returns to the list with his book Slade House. This is kind of a follow-up to The Bone Clocks. Features the same fantasy elements, the same war between supernatural creatures, good and evil.
And we'll give it away. It's being reviewed next week in the book review.
Yes, by Scarlett Thomas. Then at number 7, Alexander McCall Smith continues his number 1 ladies detective agency series with a book called The Woman Who Walked in Sunshine. That's the 16th book in the series. It's new at number 7. Another series continues up at number 4. Elizabeth George continues her Scotland Yard mystery series with a novel called A Banquet of Consequences. And series again at number 3. Patricia Cornwell is back with the 23rd book in her Kay Scarpetta medical examiner series. This book is called Depraved Heart, and it is the highest ranked newcomer on the fiction list at number 3.
All right, let's go over to nonfiction.
Nonfiction, there are even more new titles, 7 new titles out of the 15 on the list. Again, starting down at number 13, Gloria Steinem has a memoir called My Life on the Road. It's partly about her life and partly a history of the feminist movement, which, of course, she has personified for the last 50 years or more now. Then at number 12, Ted Koppel, the former ABC anchor, has a book called Lights Out, not a memoir. This is straight journalism, looking at the possibility of a terrorist attack on America's electric grid and what that would do to the government and to the citizens. He also kind of takes a side trip looking at preppers who are taking steps to prepare for that on the theory that the government is not. Then at number 11, the actress and especially musician Carrie Brownstein, famous now for Portlandia, but really she made her name as the guitarist for the Riot Girl band Slater Kinney, has a memoir called Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl. And it is especially the story of Slater Kinney and her life as a musician.
I feel like there are those people who think of her as an actress, and then there are those people who are very adamant about thinking of her as a musician.
She's
Greg among these people.
she was guitarist and sometimes singer for Slater Kinney, and they were really kind of a seminal post-punk band and on the leading edge of the whole Riot Girl movement. Very strong feminist band and just great cutting-edge rock music at the time. And they have reunited and are on the road again.
Next one is an actor-actor, not a musician-actor.
Yes, next one is an actor-actor from a long family of actor-actors. Drew Barrymore, who of course was famous as a child star and is still famous as an adult star, has her first memoir since she was 14 years old. This book is called Wildflower, new at number 9. And she looks back on her career and on life as a mother and really just talks about her wild days and her flower days, I guess. Wildflower, new at number 9.
What was her first memoir called?
When she was 14, she wrote a memoir called Little Girl Lost.
I feel like someone needs to line up the two books side by side and like compare the passages of all of those early childhood stories.
Yeah, I'm going to guess that in Little Girl Lost, she did not tell a story that she tells in this one about being drunk and 11 years old at a hotel in Germany and going and stealing people's dirty laundry out of their laundry bags and just throwing it off a balcony into a river far below.
That's the kind of story you only want to tell once, I guess. All right, what's next on the list?
Next up at number 7 is a book called Notorious RBG by Erin Carmone and Shanna Nijnik. This is a book. It's sort of a biography and sort of just a scrapbook. It grows out of the author's Tumblr feed, also called Notorious RBG, which is really a celebration of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the Supreme Court Justice. Then at number three, the radio host of Savage Nation, Michael Savage, has a new book called Government Zero. This is sort of a nonfiction analog to Michelle Welbeck's new novel. It argues that progressives and Islamicists are trying to ruin your life and control everything. And finally, at number two, just in time for your post-Halloween festivities, Stacey Schiff, the journalist and popular historian, has a book called The Witches, which looks at the Salem witch trials and kind of puts them in their historical context.
All right, let's see what we get for Thanksgiving books this year. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.